This is Car Expert.
As cool as an SQ7 or an SQ8 is, they're just not going to give you that kind of look of and feel that this car does.
And the Isuzu, this new one, is really a style-focused lifestyle ute, just like the Wildtrak. And is it good enough to lure buyers out of the class favourite?
It's probably the most American-looking Ford that Ford Australia has ever made.
Hello, my name's Mandy Turner. This week I'm joined by James Wong.
Hey, Mandy.
And William Stopford.
Mandy, how's it going?
Very good. Now, Will, you've been living a free life up in Brisbane for quite some time, pretty much COVID-free. But Joe and I down here in Melbourne, we feel absolute freedom right now because this week pretty much all the rules have been dropped. So we can now go for a drive and don't have a reason to do it. So how good does it feel, Joe?
It's almost overwhelming because it kind of hit me the other day that I was allowed to do stuff again and I didn't know what I wanted to do with myself. I was like, oh, like what do I do? Do I go get food? Do I go do this? Do I go do that? I'm sure I can speak for a lot of Melburnians in particular in saying how much of a relief it's been to kind of get back to a sense of normality. We're not quite there yet, but to being back to complete normal like the guys in Brisbane are. But it's definitely nice to be back on the road to normal. So I feel a lot more relaxed. I don't feel anxious getting in the car and driving somewhere, even if it's within whatever radius. So now it's 25 Ks, but, you know, before I would be very conscious of like going anywhere or even like just going to the shops or whatever. I just didn't really like it because I didn't want to put myself or anybody that I would come into contact at risk because, you know, I don't know. I just get really anxious about those things. So it's very nice. I've gone out and gotten my hair done. I'm blonde now. So I'm coming out of lockdown, you know, coming up being
you
like,
look
it's
gorgeous.
Oh, thank you. I was going to say it's Britney Bleep, but then I'm not Britney. So, you know, and I've still got my hair. I didn't shave it all off. So, you know, well, it's a new chapter. So, yeah, I don't know. It's exciting. Summer's back. The weather's nice. I can start playing tennis again. It's great.
Yeah, I'm pretty excited with the weather. I know weather is a boring subject to talk about, but I am excited because one of my classic cars is a convertible and I'm now pretty much allowed to drive that because if I drove any of my classics during COVID, it would almost be a police magnet because, yeah, they would say, look, you can't go grocery. That's not a typical car you'd go grocery shopping in. You know,
is this your 356, Mandy?
Yeah.
Oh, so, I remember when I came and helped you pick that up. That was so long ago now. How long have you had it?
It was. Yeah, that was 4 years ago I bought that car. So I haven't driven it since I think it was June. It was in between the first and the second wave. So I took that car out for the first time maybe a week ago on a beautiful mild day in Melbourne and oh boy it was so good.
Yeah, it's a great feeling.
Blew the cobwebs out of my hair. So yeah, I think the whole car community, well, I suppose in whole Victoria is pretty happy. I would say they've got the batteries off charge, pumped up the tyres, filled up the fuel tank again, and I'm looking forward to car shows making a return. That's the biggest thing I've missed, I think, during COVID. So
it's just kind of surreal. I'm really happy for you guys, but it sounds so unfamiliar to me hearing about all these kind of lockdown travails, because up here in Brisbane, like, we had a bit of a lockdown. Oh god, when was that, March or April? It's actually really weird how quickly this year has gone by the way. Mm-hmm. But we've just kind of it's just gone back to normal here. Like, there's more hand sanitizer in places, but it doesn't feel like it's like, what, pandemic? So I really feel sorry for you guys that you've obviously had to, that everybody listening in Melbourne and Victoria has had to be hunkered down so much, obviously for good reason, but it must be an amazing feeling to get out there. I'm actually having a party on the weekend, which is, you know, if I said that and I lived in Melbourne, you know, cops would be coming to my door. So
yeah, I would say there'd be a few Halloween parties happening this weekend as well. So all right. Let's get into car news for this week. To start off with this week's car news, it's been a big year for Isuzu, J-Wope, because we've now got the 2021 MUX that's been revealed.
Absolutely, yeah. So we are speaking to Mike Costello about the new D-Max and how it ranks against the Ford Ranger shortly. But the all-new Isuzu MU-X, which is quite popular in Australia, has just been revealed in Thailand and is about 12 months away from Australian showrooms. So it might actually be a 2022 Isuzu MU-X by the time it gets here. But basically, they've put an SUV body on the all-new D-Max platform. So the bulk of it is that you get a new design, but still looks a lot like an MUX. The biggest changes have come in terms of the technology and safety that's on board. So you get that same huge screen in the dash that offers wireless Apple CarPlay. It's completely decked out with safety systems, so autonomous emergency braking, you've got adaptive cruise control, lane keep assist, blind spot monitoring, all that stuff. The main difference between the D-Max and the MUX obviously is the SUV body. So now instead of having a tray in the back, you've got a proper tailgate and extended roof line that allows for 7 seats. And it's going to be, I would say, a really big hit here. If the old one that is currently on sale still does so well now, I imagine that this one will just sell like hotcakes because it looks great. It's got heaps of tech. And one thing that I've always loved about the MUX is that it's a proper 7-seater. Like, it's one of the few SUVs that you can fit adults in the back very comfortably. And it looks like this will continue to do the same thing. And then on top of that, it's got all of the features and technology that you would expect of a car in 2021 or 2022. So I reckon, given how well the new D-Max has rated with not just Car Expert, but just with the media in general, I feel like this new MUX is going to set the standard for that body-on-frame off-road SUV class, because it's got a reliable engine, it's got all the tech now that it didn't have before, and it's still sort of designed and packaged in a body that should resonate with people that have the old one. So I would say a lot of people are going to be happy to upgrade to this one, but also a lot of people that might have been looking at an Everest, for example, because the Everest was kind of the tech leader in that space, might now be swayed to look in an Isuzu showroom as well. But we have no idea about pricing or anything like that at the moment. We'll have to wait until closer to the launch date.
Especially considering that the current MUX is getting on a bit in years and it doesn't have as much tech as some of its rivals like the Everest. This one is going to have a huge upgrade in terms of both in-car technology and active safety technology. So that's only going to do it well. Now, the Toyota Land Cruiser Prado outsells it by a considerable margin, but right now the MUX is tracking ahead of the Everest. It's tracking ahead of the Pajero Sport, the Toyota Fortuna, all those Ute-based SUVs. So with a huge upgrade in terms of styling, I mean, the one that they revealed was in this gorgeous metallic dark brown with an orange leather interior. It's barely recognizable. That interior is barely recognizable as an MUX interior. So this is a huge step up in terms of tech and in terms of material quality. So it'll be very, very interesting to see if it can help narrow the gap between MUX sales and Prado sales. Who knows?
Joe, what price do you reckon, or where do you think it will sit in terms of the Everest? Like, we're just assuming here, obviously.
I would think that if the D-Max is anything to go by, I feel like Isuzu will try to keep the MUX as close to the current car as possible. I think they start just under 50 grand for the current model, and a lot of Isuzu tends to do a lot of sharp drive-away deals. So currently the base model actually starts a little under $44,000 before on-road costs, and it tops out just under 60. So I would say that you might see a couple of grand here and there in terms of increases, but let's say a base two-wheel drive version might land for about $45,000 or $46,000 plus on-road costs, and then a top-of-the-range one will probably be about $60,000, give or take, before on-road costs. But then you might see some drive-away deals like they've done with the D-Max. And what's really interesting here as well in terms of the pricing is that even though you get the off-road capability and also the ability to tow 3 or 3.5 tons, is that the MUX is still very much priced in line with your regular road bias SUVs like a Kia Sorento or a Mazda CX-9. So it really does give you a like priced alternative, say that if you have 3 kids or, you know, maybe even 4, so you need that extra row of seats, and the MUX definitely has one of the best third rows in that large SUV segment, whether it's a ladder frame chassis or whether it's a monocoque. But also you get that added ability to get very far off the beaten track and tow a caravan without too much troubles. You're not going to tow 3 or 3.5 tons in a Kia Sorento. You're definitely not going to do that in a CX-9 either. So for anybody that likes to get away, and I feel like after lockdown properly ends, a lot of Victorians are going to be doing a lot of road trips, I feel, and a lot of other Australians are going to be doing road trips within their own state or perhaps interstate, and they might be buying caravans as well. I think this would be a great option for that kind of stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, we will move on to the next story. Will, Volkswagen Australia are pretty keen on getting the T-Roc R and the Tiguan R here in a couple of years. Well, this is only good news, right?
Yeah, so basically they have said that the next, so the Mark 8 Golf R hatch and wagon won't arrive until 2022. And at the same time, they really want, so this is not set in stone yet, but they really want the Tiguan R and the T-Roc R to come here as well. So the Tiguan being a midsize SUV and the T-Roc being their only very recently introduced small SUV. Now, what that means is the T-Roc R would come around the time of the T-Roc's mid-cycle update, because even though it's just launched here, it has actually been on sale in Europe for a few years. So hopefully that mid-cycle update will address probably the biggest criticism I have. The main criticism I had about it, which was its interior quality, but this is really exciting news, because the small SUV segment and the midsize SUV segment, they really don't have that many sporty options. Now, the T-Roc R currently in Europe, it's got a turbo 2-liter 4-cylinder. It's got 221 kilowatts of power and 400 newton meters of torque. And the Tiguan R has 235 kilowatts and 420 newton meters, also from a 2-liter turbo 4. Both are all-wheel drive. Both have got a 7-speed dual clutch DSG automatic transmission there. So, yes, in the small SUV segment, the Hyundai Kona N, you know, we've seen Spire photos of that, that's coming along soon at some point. The new Ford Escape has actually, surprisingly, quite a punchy base engine there. So it's got 183 kilowatts right from the very base model. But there's really not that many performance options in either segment. So to see that Volkswagen is enthusiastic about bringing both here is really good news. And I think part of the reason why they're so enthusiastic is, as they're also happy to point out, this is actually, Australia is the third largest market after the UK and Germany for the Golf R. And the Golf R actually outsells the cheaper Golf GTI by around 3-1. So we're clearly pretty R crazy here. And Volkswagen's keen to jump on that, and more power to them, more power to us, actually, because we'll have more powerful SUVs.
I actually can't remember off the top of my head. Do we have the Touareg here in Australia?
No, I don't. The latest generation.
No, yeah. Which that would be nice. That would be a nice four-prong.
A giant, powerful SUV. That'd be cool.
Mm.
Okay, now we're on to some Ford news now. The plan for Ford Australia to join the electric and FEV club has taken a step back, unfortunately, with the Ford Escape FEV now delayed until the end of 2021, around a year after its first original release date. But meanwhile, the petrol version Escape is currently arriving in showrooms at the moment. Now, the Escape FEV was sold in Europe this year until it was taken off the roads in August. It was due to a problem with the lithium-ion batteries overheating, never a good thing. That issue saw four cars catch fire, and as a result, the American production crew has halted production while it sources the problem. This is according to a report from Reuters last week. So, we should get an update by the beginning of next week, or they said later this week, but I don't think we've heard any news from Ford in Europe about this. But, not a great start for Ford, actually, is it, guys?
And it's not just Ford that has had problems with battery overheating. Hyundai's had pretty well-publicized issues with overheating lithium-ion batteries and its Kona Electric. And there's a couple of other car companies I can't remember off the top of my head that have had similar issues. So it's not like Ford is alone in this respect. I was really surprised that we were actually in line to get the Escape FEV as soon as we were, because obviously it's much more important for car companies to offer a wide range of plug-in hybrids and mild hybrids than that in Europe, where they've got very strict emissions standards. So I figured that if they were going to bring it here, it was going to be a little bit of a delay. Well, it is now going to be a delay, but for an entirely different reason.
Yeah.
Well, I was actually really disappointed to read this news because I'm not sure if everybody knows, but I was working with Ford's communications team before I came back to journalism at Car Expert, and I did a lot of work with the Escape and the Escape PHEV, plug-in hybrid, however you want to say it. And I don't think people realize how big of a deal this is for that company. It's their first electrified product, and it's entering into a very critical segment for Ford and just for any manufacturer in the Australian market, because midsize SUVs are the biggest segment in Australia right now, and the outgoing Escape was in need of a dire upgrade. And obviously we've covered a lot that the RAV4 hybrid has been just lighting up the sales charts. So I was very excited to see that this car was coming, and it's a shame that it's now been delayed by 12 months, but at this stage it's still coming. Let's just hope that they can either make it a little bit earlier than originally delayed for, or at least it comes when they say it's going to come, because I think having any sort of options like that, there are a lot of people out there that are very conscious about how much fuel they're using or what their environmental impact is. And I think plug-in hybrids are a great option for Australia, because you can do about 50 Ks of zero emissions electric driving with the Escape as one example. So most people would be able to do their daily commute to and from work or to and from the school drop-off without ever touching the petrol engine. So you'd be not only reducing your fuel costs, but you'd also be reducing your environmental impact. So I think this is a really good product, and I really hope that we see more electrified products, not just from Ford, but from other manufacturers in the mainstream segments moving forward.
And it would be a feather in Ford's cap as well, because Toyota doesn't offer their plug-in hybrid RAV4 here. So Ford would MG does have the plug-in HS coming next year. And of course, you know, Mitsubishi's got the Outlander FEV, and the Eclipse Cross FEV is coming soon as well. But there's not a massive amount of plug-in hybrid options out there. So Ford would have a somewhat unique selling point.
All right. And lastly, January, the 2021 Toyota Yaris Cross. We finally have pricing and specs for this one.
Yes, we do. And you know, on the topic of hybrid SUVs, Toyota's added just another one to its portfolio. So the new Yaris Cross is, as the name suggests, basically a bigger SUV version of the Yaris City car. But unlike the hatchback, it's actually reasonably priced. So it starts at $26,990 before on-road costs for the base model, and tops out at nearly $38,000 for the flagship. There's three trim levels, three engine options. Well, technically two engine options, but three drivetrain choices. So you can get the same engines that you can get in the Yaris hatch. So 1.5-litre three-cylinder petrol engine or a 1.5-litre three-cylinder petrol hybrid. But the hybrid in the Yaris Cross also allows for the option of all-wheel drive. So those models get an additional electric motor on the rear axle. And so it's a really interesting car, because it's probably more compact than, say, you know, your, I don't know, it's probably smaller than like a Qashqai or like a Kia Seltos, but it's obviously playing in that same price bracket and in that same segment.
How big would you compare it to the CHR?
Well, yeah, it's meant to slot below the CHR. So you kind of see the CHR as like their small SUV offering, and then the Yaris Cross would kind of be their light SUV offering. Yeah. But yeah, obviously it's starting in the upper part of the $20,000 bracket. So it's a bit more of a premium entry point, but I guess it's kind of like what a lot of manufacturers are having to do now with all of the standard tech and features that they're shoving into these cars. And the Yaris Cross is no different. It's fully decked out with safety features. You've got autonomous emergency braking. You've got, and that also has a front cross traffic function. So a lot of new cars will start to see having this function where if you're turning into an intersection and the car thinks that you're going to hit another car that's coming the other way, it'll actually slam on the brakes for you. I actually had that experience with the Audi S7 last week, and I shat myself because I thought that I had been rear-ended, but it's actually because the car thought I was going to turn into somebody. It also has emergency steering assist, lane keeping assist, road sign recognition, and auto high beam as standard across the range, which is quite comprehensive. And I think that's something that Toyota's been having as a point of difference lately. Although the prices have gone up, all of their vehicles basically come decked out with all of the requisite safety features. It also has adaptive cruise control that covers all speeds, a reversing camera, And then the upper models get blind spot monitoring. And then also it gets that cool center airbag that stops the front passengers from clashing heads in an whatever impact, a side impact, front impact, or whatever. So it's very, it's designed to be very technologically advanced, especially in the safety and assistance front. But it only measures, like, it's under 4.2 meters long. So this thing is tiny. But it also packs a 390-litre boot in front-wheel drive, guys. So despite its compact dimensions, it looks to be quite practical, and it's still sort of boxy looking, so I'd imagine that the headroom in the back would be pretty good. So, and we also have the Corolla Cross coming at the end of next year. So Toyota's going to go from having a fairly limited small SUV crossover lineup to having quite a full one very soon, because you'll have Yaris Cross covering the light segment. You'll have both CHR and Corolla Cross covering the small. Then you've got RAV4 in medium, and then you've got Fortuna and Land Cruiser Prado in the large. Then all the other Land Cruiser models in upper large. It's crazy how they're managing to cover all these segments now. And being able to, what was also really cool about this car is that it offers a hybrid model, which is a class first, and it's all quite affordable. So it's really not that different to what the normal Yaris pricing is. So a base Yaris GX Hybrid is going to cost you $28,990 before on-road costs, which to me sounds like a bit of a bargain, because there's nothing else in the segment like it, and it will use under 4 liters per 100 Ks, which is astonishing, to be honest. So I'm very, very keen to get a few of these through the garage and just have a steer, because it just looks like a cool thing.
These would sell their tits off, wouldn't they?
I would, when yes.
See how successful the RAV4 is. I know it's a much larger car, but wow. This will be really popular, you would assume, with maybe first car buyers on P-platers driving around the city who doesn't really have a lot of money. And
absolutely. Well, you still need a lot of money. $30,000 is not a cheap car, but at the same time.
In terms of economy and all that. Yeah,
absolutely. Like, I think we've seen that a lot of people have graduated from, you know, driving maybe a Volkswagen Polo or a Mazda 2, and now they're starting to drive CX-3s, CHRs and the like. The Toyota CHR is already very popular, and that starts at about $30,000 before on road. So the fact that this brings down that entry point a little bit, it's also available in a heap of cool colors. You can get a contrasting roof on the top spec model. It's just, I think Toyota's really just hitting the nail on the head with the demographic. And I think, like you say, Mandy, I imagine that we'll start to see a lot of these on the road over the next 6 months.
You can read more on carexpert.com.au and click the car news link. Joe, you've been driving the Audi S7 recently, which is strange because Tony Crawford usually drives Audis.
Yes.
So what did you think of the car?
Oh, well, it's just, you look at it and it's just stunning, isn't it? Like, it's the Audi A7 and then subsequently the S7 and the RS7 have just been style icons for I don't even know how long, since the first one came along, maybe a decade ago. And when I saw that my name was next to it, I had a little bit of a moment, because I just couldn't believe that I was being given the keys to this thing. So the new one starts just a little under $160,000. And one of the biggest changes for the new generation, other than obviously the design and all the tech that comes with all the new Audis these days, is the fact that they've taken out the old V8 engine and put in a V6. And so now it displaces 2.9 litres and it's got two turbochargers, and it's basically the same one that you'll find in the RS4 and RS5, but also several Porsche models. So the Cayenne and the Panamera, they all use this engine, and I think the Macan Turbo does as well, which I've also driven. So it's a really interesting engine, because you look at it on paper and it's got more power and torque than the old V8 did, but then people will still go like, oh, well, it's a V6, it's not a V8. And also because the car is so big, I wasn't sure what to expect in terms of how it handled and what it was like to drive day to day. Because obviously we've only just started coming out of lockdown in Melbourne. So, you know, we're just slowly getting out and about, you know, driving this thing around. And it's just an incredible daily driver. Like, I reviewed the BMW M550 recently, and I just couldn't believe with how easy of a car that was to drive day to day. And it really made me realize why people still love these big German luxury sedans. And with this case, it's a hatchback, but let's just say it's a sedan for now. And it's just beautiful. Like, the V6 has a really unique and refined character to it. And it may not have the burble and the growl of the old V8, but I think that, you know, as things mature and refine as they get older, like people do,
technology does, all sorts of things do. I think the S7's kind of done the same thing. It's not as, you know, brutish and brash as the old one, but I think that it still maintains that it's still ridiculously fast. Like, it can do 0 to 100 in a claim 4.6 seconds, which is really as fast as anyone wow. is ever going to need to go. And, you know, you can really imagine somebody, you know, some German businessman will be driving this at 250 on the Autobahn back in Germany, but here you're never going to use that kind of capability. And so I think that if you're looking at it like a performance Audi, it's kind of similar how I view BMW products as well. Normally the S or M performance model will do 95% of what you want it to do or what you require from like a sporty, fast luxury car. And I think with the S7, like it's got air suspension, so it's super comfortable around town. It was on ridiculously sized 21-inch alloys. So I saw the wheels and I was like, this is going to be awful to sit to ride over mm-hmm. potholes and stuff in suburbia. But it ended up being really, really comfortable. And if you leave it in its comfort setting, it raises up a little bit, the damper soften, and it's just it drives like a beautiful luxury sedan should. And then if you put it into dynamic, it firms everything up. The steering weight's up a little bit. And then the exhaust opens. So it's got like an adaptive exhaust system there too, which is quite nice. I fiddled a little bit with the settings and found an individual mode where I had basically everything in comfort, but I had the exhaust on sport. So that was nice. When you start it up, it has like it almost does like a cold start, high rev. So it gets like that really trumpety V6 sort of growl, which is a really nice sound. And then when you're, you know, putting around in traffic, you give it a little bit of a heavy foot, and then it sort of sings quite nicely once you get past about the 3000 rev mark. And then beyond the engine and the performance of it, it's just got a lovely interior. Like I'm obsessed with the new Audi interiors. That MMI dual touchscreen layout for the center stack, I think, is a really great example of how technology and design can kind of come together in a conventional way, even though it's very new age. And that kind of might sound a bit like an oxymoron, but the fact that I'm a big fan of having all this new age tech and whatever integrated in a very normal way, which is kind of why I love my Golf so much. Because if you've got like the virtual cockpit, you've got a nice big screen, but it's sort of still in a normal dash layout that doesn't feel super avant-garde, if that makes sense. So like that's I like it that way. I know a lot of people like the tablet style screens and, you know, having it look flashy so that you can be like, oh, I've got the latest one. But I think that the way that Audi's done it is so clean, so refined, and it just feels really classy when you sit in it. The only issue I had with the interior was a creaky driver's door, which was a little bit annoying. I know that a couple of the Audi press cars that we've had recently have had like a little creak here and there, which I'm sure if you went to the dealer, it would just go and be fixed. But
it's WD-40.
Yeah. Yeah, or, you know, if the tin man's walking around with his oil can, just give it a couple of squirts, I don't know. But, yeah, so I, overall, like, I just love this car. It's really stupid. Like, there's no real need for a car like that. Because, you know, an S6 will do the same job but have a little bit more headroom. And then, to be honest, like, I think if you really want a sporty, practical Audi, I think the RS4, which is the same engine in a little wagon package, which is probably still more practical anyway, is actually cheaper than the S7 and it's faster. So, like, it's a funny thing. Like, I feel like this one, you really have to want the S7 body to buy it, which is a very big selling point because the thing's gorgeous and like the lights and everything. When it's got this cool little startup and shut off function that when you lock or unlock the car, the lights do this little dance and it's really, really cool. It looks like a robot waking up and it does the reverse when you turn it off. So it's just like it's a light show. It's a technological masterpiece. It's a design, you know, showcase. It's all sorts of things. And I think that it's just, people should really get back into buying cars like this. Like there's no way, as cool as an SQ7 or an SQ8 is, they're just not going to give you that kind of look of and feel that this car does. Because like just the class that this thing exudes is just on another level, I think.
Makes you feel special.
And for sure. It's pretty practical as well because it is a hatchback. And that's what I really love about the A7 and by extension the S7 is that Audi could have just copied Mercedes-Benz and just done a four-door coupe like Mercedes had done with the CLS and then what BMW did with the 6 Series Grand Coupe. But they made a hatchback. And that's just, it looks amazing. but it's practical as well. It's almost the best of both worlds without getting a wagon.
Except the rear, the second row isn't as practical as you might think. Like I'm just tall. Over, I'd say I'm 6 foot one, which really isn't that tall in the big scheme of things nowadays. So like when you, if my head is already touching the ceiling and the back seat is a bit upright, I think that if you have maybe smaller kids, this car's fine. But me sitting behind my own driving position was a little bit tight and it probably wasn't very, it wouldn't be very comfortable over a longer journey. The boot's huge, don't get me wrong, and you're right on that one, Will. But I think that if you really want a more, if you're still looking for a family practical, you know, sort of family car, but you've got like larger kids or they're growing into teenagers where they start getting to around my height, I think you'd probably be better off even with the S6 or, you know, getting an RS4 because you just need that. That sloping roof line is nice to look at, but it doesn't really allow for taller people in the back.
I wonder what demographic Audi were targeting with this, perhaps business people, couples?
Yeah, maybe retiree couples or something, or like, you know, older. Yeah, it's definitely for that kind of person, I think, or a very young, style-focused, affluent buyer, I guess. But I don't think there'd be a lot of people my age, for example, with 170 grand to splash on an Audi, but you never know. But yeah, it's not the best for taller people in the back, but that's really the only complaint practicality-wise because, yeah, the boot's huge.
Yeah. Keep your eyes on carexpert.com.au for the Audi S7 review coming up very soon. The comparison we've all been waiting for is here. The Ford Ranger versus Isuzu D-Max. And Mike Costello joins us to talk to us about them. Hello, Mike.
Hello, guys.
What spec models have we got head-to-head here?
Right, so we have the D-Max in its flagship X-Terrain, guys, which is the top-of-the-range model. It has a six-month waiting list on it, so it's obviously hugely in demand. And we're putting that up against the Ford Ranger Wildtrak in bi-turbo, guys. And the main reason for that was the X-Terrain D-Max has the sail plane, the rolling hardcover, the wheel arches, the kind of body kit that you get on pickups now, and the Wildtrak has that too. So they're both pitched as the, I guess, decorated and luxurious options in the range. Both of them hugely well-credentialed and both of them have picked up really solid reviews. The Range has obviously been one of the critical darlings for a very long time, and the new D-Max is sort of taking all before it in its new incarnation. Now, there is a little bit of a price discrepancy, which is quite interesting, because while the list price of the X-Terrain is $62,900, its actual drive-away price is $58,990. Whereas the current driveaway offer on the Wildtrak is $67,490. So right off the bat, the Ford is on the back foot and at a little bit of a disadvantage. But nevertheless, these two cars stack up on paper really, really well.
So the D-Max is all new. How does it stack up with the Ranger? How old is the current generation now?
Oh, the Ranger goes back almost a decade, but in fairness to Ford, the company has constantly updated it. So it's got an entirely different screen to when it first launched. It's got a 2-litre bi-turbo engine. So it's a sequential turbo system where a bypass valve activates at higher engine speed. So that secondary turbo comes online. 10-speed automatic, the Ford Pass connected app, some new features. So while we say the current Ranger has been around in its, you know, present incarnation for a long time, in reality it has been so constantly updated that it's sort of a very different car. But in a lot of ways, the Isuzu really does show how much more modern it is. So it has a bigger screen inside, 9 inches versus 8. It has wireless Apple CarPlay. It has blind spot monitoring. It has a center airbag. So a little bit more of that active safety technology compared to the Ford, which is nevertheless really well equipped. But I guess the question for us was, ultimately what we wanted to address here was, the Ranger Wildtrak has become, alongside obviously the Hilux, the default choice for anyone who's got a bit of coin to spend on a luxurious, family-friendly, all-day ute. And the Isuzu historically was kind of a more utilitarian offering, but this new one is really a style-focused lifestyle ute, just like the Wildtrak. And is it good enough to actually lure buyers out of the class favourite?
Well, in your opinion, which one is the better looker in terms of styling?
In terms of styling, I mean, that's a really interesting one. I think the thing that the Range has always had going for it is that it's a little bigger than most of its competitors, and it's got that really – it was sort of the first pickup in a while to have that really butch, macho design language. It's very American in the way that it looks, and clearly that's resonated with buyers a lot. The new D-Max is a pretty sharp-looking thing, though. I'm not so sure I love the sailplane in place of a traditional bar. The alloy wheels are a little bit of an acquired taste. There's a heck of a lot going on, but you certainly couldn't accuse Isuzu of being boring.
Moko, obviously the Isuzu D-Max has gone through a very comprehensive overhaul. I've spent a bit of time in both utes over the newest Isuzu, and then obviously I've spent a bit of time in Ford Rangers in the last few years. One of the biggest points of difference for the Ranger, I guess, is that it's designed and developed in Australia, you know, and focusing a lot on Australian wants and needs. Like, how does the new D-Max for you compare in terms of how it drives? Because obviously that's a big part of owning a ute, is driving it.
Yeah, well, you're 100% right. One of my favorite things to do when I have a Ranger and COVID isn't stopping me from leaving my bubble is I like to drive out to the Ford Proving Ground in the Yuyangs in regional Victoria and drive the Ranger outside the Ford Proving Ground, because those are the literal roads where the vehicle sold all over the world was R&D'd and developed. And it's quite rare to have that opportunity. And for a long time, the Ranger has just been the nicest in terms of its insulation, in terms of its ride quality, the way that it irons out sharp hits, in terms of its electric assisted steering, which is incredibly light and very wieldy around town. But the new D-Max really does give it a hell of a shake. So we had our Sydney guy, Kurt Dupre, our very experienced Sydney journalist, Kurt Dupre, conduct this test. And he is definitely an authority when it comes on specifically to unladen and primary ride quality of pickups like this. And he could not be more fulsome in his praise for how good this new D-Max rides. And I can second that, having spent quite a lot of time in the X-Terrain as well. It's rolling on the same Bridgestone Dueler tyres, the same 18-inch wheel dimensions as the Ranger, very similar suspension in terms of Leafs at the back, McPherson struts, independent suspension up the front. And the way that it rides over B roads, be it choppy, corrugated gravel, or be they potholes or things like that, it just floats beautifully. But it's never busy or jerky at the back if the tub isn't full of something weighing it down. The leaf springs aren't so taut and geared towards load that it bucks and moves around off center. So it's actually a really impressive thing. Drives a lot like an SUV with a tub attached, if you can think about it in those terms, rather than a conventional commercial vehicle. And that's really what these are going for. So when it comes to that, really quite hard to split.
Did Kurt have a chance to tow with these utes?
So this test specifically was focused more towards the daily urban and extra-urban driving. Okay. So there was no towing involved here. I actually have got quite a bit of experience towing with both of these pickups, though. So I've towed a 3-ton caravan up Mount Ousley in New South Wales, which is a notoriously difficult, long, steep hill in a Ranger bi-turbo, because it's got that 2-litre turbo. A lot of people are dubious about a small displacement engine. It's actually really strong because it's got a 10-speed gearbox, which means that there's very closely stacked together ratio. So the engine is never working quite as hard as it needs to. But of course, the D-Max has that classic 3-litre out of the N-Series truck diesel. And this new one is an evolved engine compared to the previous iteration, but it's fundamentally the same setup. Now, here's the really interesting part. Whether it's towing or whether it's unladen or whether it's got something in the tub, the 3-litre in the Isuzu has lower power and torque than the Ranger. So the 3-litre has 140 kilowatt and 450 newton metres, whereas the Ranger, smaller engine again, 157 kilowatt, 500 newton metres. So you think, okay, maybe the Ranger is going to be quicker. But the funny thing is, in the real world, forget what's on paper, the D-Max actually feels far more effortless and far more sprightly. So off the line, you get this beautiful surge of torque almost instantaneously, and it seems to hold that high level of torque longer across the rev band. So its actual torque curve is much flatter than the Ranger's. The Ranger always feels very relaxed because it always wants to upshift to the highest gear possible to conserve fuel. But as such, it can feel a little bit lazy from time to time. It's a lot better than the 3.2-litre five-cylinder with the six-speed auto that you can still get in the Ranger. The 2-litre with the 10-speed auto would definitely be my choice. But if I were a grey nomad and I was towing a big heavy van all day long, I actually think the Isuzu still really ticks the box in that regard. And it's not just because of the displacement of the engine, but if you can put aside the actual specs, it feels punchier as well. And the other side of that is The main reason why Ford has the smaller displacement engine with the start-stop system is that the fuel use claim is lower. So 7.4 litres every 100 k's of diesel compared to 8 litres with the Isuzu. But in Kurt's real-world testing, the Isuzu was actually more efficient as well. The Isuzu 100% matched the factory claim, whereas the Ranger blew out to 9.4. So that does tell you that because that engine's smaller and because the Ranger's heavier, it is having to work just that little bit harder, even if it doesn't feel like it from the seat of the pants. So if I was buying a pickup truck, to put an end to this long, waffly answer, and I was towing a lot of the time, I think I would be erring towards the D-Max.
Okay. But which did Kurt give the win to?
Well, so it was an incredibly hard decision. And this is a really long, beautifully written feature. I don't want to, you know, give too much away here. I'd encourage all of you to go to carexpert.com.au and check out this feature that Kurt's written. It's long, it's detailed, it's full of a lot of information. There are some videos at the bottom that we've done previously that you can check out. The win, though, has gone by 0.1 or 0.1 ratings points. I'm not really sure how we word that. To the new kid on the block, the Isuzu D-Max. So it's safe to say that up until now, the Ranger has been the benchmark, but we think, given the D-Max's keener pricing, given its slightly longer warranty, given its slightly punchier engine and more high-tech interior, that it has overtaken the Ranger as, well, to our mind thus far, the preferred sort of lifestyle top-of-the-range pickup in its class. But at the same time, if your heart's set on a Ranger, that did not at all dissuade from us recommending the Ranger if it's the one you want. So in other words, if you've got no particular baggage going into the test and you just want the best one, we think the D-Max takes the edge now. But if you're in love with the Ranger and you just think it's awesome, don't feel bad with your decision because it's still a very solid proposition. 8.3 out of 10 Kurt gave it versus 8.4 for the D-Max. So about the closest victory you can possibly imagine. Now, the interesting follow-up to this is, we've obviously been quite delayed in comparison testing that we can do in Melbourne during this whole second wave, but things are opening up now. We've booked four of the best pickups on the market for a very imminent comparison test. We're getting the D-Max back. We're getting the Ranger back, albeit in different variants, so the XLT Ranger versus the LSU D-Max, and we're throwing in the new BT50 from Mazda and, of course, the Toyota Hilux SR5 in updated guise. We will be doing off-roading in that. We will have some loads in the tubs. We'll do a really detailed test of those four to see if, you know, we stick with this verdict. But for the time being, at the top of the tree, D-Max gets the nod.
That's incredible. And
it really is. It's always good to crown a new segment leader, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. And so, so close too. So as Mike said, jump on the site and have a look at Kurt's write-up. Mike Costello, thank you so much.
Absolute pleasure.
Will, we really enjoyed your 10 Holdens You May Have Forgotten About piece that you wrote a little while ago, and you spoke about them on the podcast, but now you've written a part two called 10 Fords You May Have Forgotten About. How do you manage to find these cars?
I just go trawling for the most obscure stuff that I can find. And there's certainly been lots of very rare Falcon variants over the years and rare Aussie-made Fords. But I try to do a variety when I do these articles, and I will do more of these articles in future, so stay tuned. So I've got a good mix of Aussie-made Fords you may have forgotten about and some of their more obscure imported stuff. So we've got everything from designer label special editions to weird kind of cobbled together four-wheel drives. There's a lot in there.
The Falcon four-wheel drive ute was the one that really stuck out to me. Such a cool looking thing. It sort of looks like something that's just come out of a war.
Yeah, I think from what I recall, I couldn't quite get a verification on this, but my understanding is that Ford was building it to satisfy a military contract. That's what I read somewhere. And then the military, the Australian Army said, no, we want something like a body-on-frame construction instead of a unibody Falcon. But they went to all of this effort of tooling up a unibody Falcon with a solid front axle. And I'd actually almost forgotten about this. I remember reading about this in a book in the State Library a few years ago, and then I was putting together this article, and then I just happened to remember I'd taken some notes a few years back, and I stumbled across this again. So it was so obscure that I forgot about it. But it was made right here in in Brisbane, which is quite fun. Actually, Ford's facility in Eagle Farm, and I'm currently talking to you from Eagle Farm. So I don't know where it was, but if I wander down the road, maybe I can see where they used to make four-wheel drive Falcons. And that was, everyone thinks, you know, a lot of people think that the Territory was the first four-wheel drive Falcon derivative that was made here. But no, Ford Australia was doing this, you do the math, many years ago.
I don't think I've ever seen one. I'm assuming they didn't really make many.
No, they didn't make many at all. They made 432. My understanding is, I couldn't quite understand why they made 432. But basically, whoever does have one, my understanding is that they're quite sought after, and people definitely, they don't change hands very often because people realize, people who go looking for something like this realize what they found and they hold on to it.
Yeah. Now, the Landau, I can see so much American inspiration in this. I don't know how I feel about this car.
Oh, it's really fascinating. So I love 70s American cars, not because they're good, because in most cases they're not, but because it's such a fascinating decade of American car history. And what I find really interesting, I did an article about this at the historical blog that I used to write for. We recycle American names like Ford and Chrysler and Holden, all recycled American names with just absolute regularity. So if you name a Ford or a Holden, that name has been used on an American product. So the Holden Calais, for example, Calais was used by Cadillac. Calais was also used by Oldsmobile. Now, the Ford Landau is very interesting because at the time in the 70s, Ford was not just reusing American names. They were just stealing design, more borrowing design cues from their American counterparts left, right, and center. Everything on this, from the vinyl roof to the hidden headlights, it's all very American, except if you showed this to an American, particularly a 70s American car enthusiast, they would just look at it and think, what the hell is this? Because if this was an American personal luxury coupe, it would have a much more upright roof line. It would be more massive, because you've got to think our full size, especially back in the 70s, was more what the Valiant here was, like a proper family size car. That was a compact in the States, so that gives you an idea of how much bigger cars were in America back then. But this, if this was a personal luxury coupe in America, it would be so much more upright and boxier and longer. And this, I mean, it's a Falcon hardtop. It's a Falcon coupe that they've kind of just slapped a vinyl roof on. They haven't adjusted the wheelbase. They put some hidden headlights on. So it's this very, very weird mix of sporty body styling but luxury American, like, addenda. And the name as well, Landau, it was once a very commonly used name, because a Landau roof is actually a type of vinyl roof design. So it's probably the most American-looking Ford that Ford Australia has ever made. And I imagine the values of these are probably through the roof, even though they weren't super popular new.
Mm. There's one that really stood out to me. You know, when we think of Mondeo, it's not really, you know, huge groundbreaking design, but the Mondeo ST24, was that in the 90s or early 2000s? Because I actually don't mind the look of that thing.
It does look good, doesn't it? Introduced it in 2000. So the midsize segment, I mean, it's other than the Camry, it's not doing too great nowadays, but it goes through weird kind of peaks and troughs. And in the 90s, it was getting squeezed from small cars below, which were obviously getting bigger and more comfortable. But also people would just go, oh, well, I could just get a Falcon. I could just get a Commodore. What's the point of getting a midsize car? So the Mondeo wasn't doing too well. The Mondeo had been brought here in 1995 to replace the Telstar, because the exchange rate was just making that pretty uncompetitive. So they brought in the Mondeo, wasn't selling too well. So in 2000, they actually rebooted it. So they completely changed the model structure, and they brought in this wonderful flagship model with a 2.5 litre V6. I mean, 125 kilowatts of power doesn't sound that great now, but this, you know, it was a Mondeo, so it handled well. And that was a pretty decent amount of power for the time. But the Mondeo just did not sell any better after this little reboot. So they just axed it after 2000. So we actually missed out an entire generation of Mondeo that came after this. So effectively, if you have got a Ford Mondeo ST24 out there, wow, you did well, because there are not many left, I can imagine, because this was a one-year-only model.
Yeah. That generation of Mondeo has a special place in my heart, because I used to play a video game called Toka Touring. There was the UK, the British touring car game on the computer, and this generation of Mondeo was featured in that game. And I remember I used to be so obsessed with the Mondeo, and I tried to get my parents to buy one when I was a kid because I used to love playing it on the game. And they had, and this was available at that time. So it was just a cool looking thing. It's interesting to see how the designs changed over the years. Like, I was just about to interject before and say, this is like looking through someone's, like, you know, this is your life. And if you look at, you know, if say it's Ford Australia, this is your life. And just, there's like that weird patch where the designs got a bit funny. So, you know, when people started doing mullets and stuff, like, you know, that squared off Fairlane, or the Landau that looks a bit funny at the front, or even like the Focus CC, which again is something I really liked. And then also that Laser Lynx, there used to be so many of those running around Melbourne. I used to see them all the time.
Really?
Hit things, but I don't know why they were all, I think they're popular secondhand car buys or something. But there was a lot of them around, and I used to see a lot of these Ford Cougars, those coupes around as well. They became very popular secondhand car buys. Maybe it's just a Melbourne thing. But, yeah, then you get to, like, the stage where that first generation Cougar started heading over here and everything got a bit more normal. And that five-cylinder in that Cougar was really cool. It's a shame that they didn't bring it till very late in the life cycle.
Oh, when you said Cougar, I thought you were saying Cougar, but you were saying Cougar. Because I got to tell you, Cougar is one of the most awful Ford names that they conceived, because in an Australian accent, it sounds like you're saying Cougar. And I don't know why you would, and then this, like, what is K-U-G-A? What does that even mean? But I will say about not the Cougar, but the Cougar. I love that era of Ford design. That was when they called it New Edge design. That did bring us things like the AU Falcon and the 96 Taurus. But you know what? Kudos for Ford for actually really being adventurous with their designs, even on mainstream cars. And that Cougar really is an attractive coupe. It just didn't seem to do well in any market it was sold in. And that's why Ford just withdrew from the segment.
It's funny that the AU Falcon is now considered, would you call it iconic or infamous in its design these days?
Yeah, look, it's actually, and look, I might get some criticism for saying this, but I think the design has actually aged really well. And I know I've seen those memes that get shared around on Facebook where it's a picture of the rear end of an AU Falcon and the rear of a first generation Mercedes CLS. Now, I'm not saying the CLS looks like an AU Falcon, but I think the really kind of sloped sides and the little kind of, I don't even know how you would describe the tail of that car. It doesn't look completely outdated. It doesn't look like some big old boxy barge from decades ago. It still looks pretty fresh. Now, that being said, the first car I bought was a BA Falcon, which was a very, very heavy redesign of the AU with much more conservative styling, but very handsome styling and a much better interior. So
I think the was it the Mark III or Series 3 of the AU Falcon, which got a much cleaner front end? I think that's the one that's aged the best. The first lot of AU Falcons that had that almost closed grille and sort of like Stingray or Shark style front end, that didn't age very well because that's very specific to that time, I think, like that late 90s new millennium period. But then the Series 2 or Series 3, they gave it a more conventional grille and a bit like wider-eyed headlights, which gave it a more maybe classic face. I think that one's aged really well. But I think also the interior of that car, and this is probably something that all Fords of that time sort of had, now that I look back at the Mondeo and the Cougar, they had that really weird circly, squirkly design language in the interior, which was very specific to the 90s era of Fords, now that I think about it. And like all of the cars of that time from them had that. Like you look at the Mondeo interior there, it has it. The AU Falcon had it. Pretty sure the Focus had it at that time too. And like all those, it was very obviously futuristic for the time, but I think something that I've started to notice now with today's car designs as well is that
things like that look cool when they come out, but they age very, very badly, because once you get to the next generation and they do something crazier again, it just dates and sort of freezes in that point in time. And a lot of these curvy spaceship new age designs kind of did that for Ford, I feel. Whereas, you know, you get something that's a bit more classic and clean, straight lines, say even like, you know, a Golf, for example, from that time, a Mark III or Mark IV Golf compared to a first generation Focus, it still looks a lot more modern and a lot more classic than the Ford equivalent of that time. So it's just really interesting to kind of take a step back and have a look at these things. It's very cool. So well done, Will, on this piece, because it's very informative and a nice trip down memory lane.
I definitely agree with what you're saying there with design. If I could make one book recommendation to anybody listening and to you guys as well, Car by Mary Walton. She was a journalist that was invited to basically sit in on the development of the 1996 Ford Taurus. Now, for those of you who aren't aware, when the first generation Taurus came out in 1986, it was a big freaking deal for Ford in the US, because it was a front-wheel drive large-ish mid-sized sedan. It had very aerodynamic Audi-inspired styling that just completely blew everybody away. Ford actually thought it was going to be such a shock that they kept the older LTD running alongside it for a year. But what that means when you create such an almost iconic design that just instantly shakes up a segment is there's a lot of pressure on you to blow people's socks off again the next time. So when they were developing the 96 Taurus, they were like, oh no, we've got to do something different here. We've got to somehow beat the Camry and the Accord, but also we've got to have a daring, dashing design. And that's why the Taurus has got all these ovals, because they were just like, well, this will completely revolutionize the segment, just like the 86 Taurus did. And part of that, James, was the integrated control panel, which was that round panel of switch gear in the middle of the dash, which makes putting an aftermarket head unit in, I imagine, quite difficult. But they thought that they just had a really good idea there, and they were so committed to having this daring new design that they plunged ahead. And we all know how things went. The Taurus, I'm not going to get into the whole long story of the Taurus here. It's fascinating enough as it is. But in the States, by 2000, they rushed along a very conservative redesign, much like Ford Australia did with the AU and then the BA Falcon. So there you go, except the BA Falcon was better.
God, we could have a whole podcast just on this subject.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Australian cars and American cars, just you get me talking and no, I won't shut up, so.
But it is fascinating. Have you got an idea on your third story?
Yes. I'm thinking for the next one, I'll look at 10 Chryslers you may have forgotten about. But obviously these articles are, you know, people seem to be receiving them quite well. So if anybody has any idea of other articles you might like to see in this series, absolutely shoot us a line at podcast@carexpert.com.au. But yeah, next one looks like it's going to be Chrysler. So we'll be looking at some obscure local variants, but also some imported models. I'm trying to keep these with kind of an Australian focus. But yeah, we'll see how things go.
We'll have to talk about that on the podcast as well. The 10 Fords You May Have Forgotten About article is now up at carexpert.com.au. Please go and have a read. It's worth it. And that brings an end to this week's podcast. What can we look forward to coming up on the site this week, Joe?
Well, I'm looking at the colour now. It's so good to see so many cars in Melbourne. So we've got a Ute comparison coming up next week. So you'll see the D-Max, the BT50, Ranger and Hilux going head-to-head very soon. I'm currently driving the Nissan Qashqai Midnight Edition, which continues into next week. So that's a launch loan, which will be on the site very soon. And there's also a Jaguar F-Type R, which is a very cool car to have. So excited to see those. In Sydney, we have one of the new Hyundai i30s. We've also got a launch review for the Ford Escape coming soon. Another Jaguar F-Type, but a P380, not an R. A new Mercedes E-Class. And then in Brisbane, we're coming out of a Mazda MX-5 GT and a Mercedes AMG GLE 350. 353, wow, that's not very good. GLE 53 Coupe and going into a Subaru Forester. So a really cool mix of cars coming through this coming week.
Lovely. And Will, you're off to a launch next week. Where are you going?
Yes, I'm going to an in-person launch event. Remember those? I will be going to the launch event for the Genesis G80 and the Genesis GV80.
Oh, cool. I'm very jealous.
Yes, it is really exciting because for those who don't know, I actually own a 2015 Hyundai Genesis Ultimate, which was effectively renamed their Genesis G80. So I'll actually be driving the next generation version of the car I currently have, which is always exciting to see what a car company has come up with next. We've got the pricing and specs article has gone live today for the G80, so people can check that out on carexpert.com.au. And the GV80 pricing and specs article went live a little while ago. But it's very, very, very exciting to see what this upstart luxury brand is doing.
For sure. That's really cool. I'm so jealous. I hope they send me on the Golf launch in 2021, you know, since I'm a golf owner.
Yeah, exactly.
James Wong and William Stopford, thank you very much.
Thanks, Mandy.
Thanks, Mandy.